I'm Representative Stephen Watt from Rock Springs, Wyoming.
My name is Mark Farnham. I'm an inmate at the Torrington Medium Security Institution, and I'm the man that shot Steve Watt 31 years ago.
How do you want to start out telling your story? Like, where does it start for you?
For me?
Yeah.
March 18th, 1982. And actually, it would be, 31 years?
Yeah.
Yeah. 31 years ago. March 18th, 1982, I was a Wyoming State Trooper, 26 years old. On the 18th of March, I was assigned to attend a funeral for a Rock Springs City officer's son. And so as I dressed that morning, I decided not to wear my bulletproof vest, something I wore every single day. And the reason I bring that up is because I should have had my vest on that day. But I had my whole day planned to do paperwork and to go to the funeral. But while I was having lunch, my dispatcher called and told me that there had been an armed robbery down in Craig, Colorado. She gave me a description of the man and told me that a man fitting that description had been seen around the Wyoming-Colorado state line driving a red sports car. And I went south of Rock Springs to look for this red sports car. And here, a little red car come by me, and I stopped them to ask them if they had seen the bank robber. And it wasn't the bank robber. It was two teenagers and a grandpa and grandma. And so I turned them loose and kept going south. And here come a little brown compact, and I decided to stop that vehicle and ask the man if he had seen this bank robber. And it turned out he was the bank robber.
So, okay, where does it start for you then?
For me, it starts a year or two earlier. I was going to college at the University of Minnesota, and I was selling cocaine, and I become addicted to cocaine at the because of the sales and being around it all the time. And I was using more than I was selling, and I got deeply in debt, and I just couldn't get out of debt, so I decided to come out to Wyoming to work in the oil fields to pay off the debts. So I was going to take a year or two off of school, work in the oil fields, and go back to college. And when I came to Wyoming, the oil fields didn't work out very well. I don't have any mechanical inclination whatsoever. And I worked in Jackson for a while. I tried a couple ideas to make some quick money that didn't work out, and the debts continued to compound themselves. And one day, my rent was due, the tires are bald in the car, and there's no money. And everybody wants their money that I've been owing for several years all at the same time. And when I grew up, I believed that a man solves his own problems. And so I didn't reach out to family or friends and say, hey, I'm in over my head, what do I do? So I stressed for a number of weeks, and I decided I'd rob a bank to pay off the bills and didn't think about the people in the bank or any peace officers that might be affected. So I decided to go rob a bank to pay off my bills. And I said, if I'm caught, well, then I can't pay off my bills, so my obligation is resolved. And if I get away, then I can pay off my bills. So I decided to rob a bank, and I went out of state from Wyoming. I was living in Jackson at the time because I was afraid if they got pictures in the bank of the bank robber, they might show it in the newspapers. And I went to Craig, Colorado, and the night before I had Steamboat, and that morning when I got up to go rob the bank, I had $2 left, and that was all I had. If I didn't rob the bank, I didn't have enough to get gas even to get home. So I robbed the bank to pay off my debts. And when I came out of the bank, I was surprised within 10 minutes they had the bank robbery on the AM radio. And I thought for sure I was going to be caught. And then they had this description of a red sports car. So then I thought, okay, I'm going to make it. I'm going to get away because they had the wrong description of the wrong car. And when Steve pulled me over, at that moment I wasn't thinking about anyone else, just thinking about myself. And I didn't want to go to prison. I didn't want to pay the consequences. And I didn't see a man or a father or a son or a brother. I just saw something, someone in my way. And so I got out and I shot him 5 times. I tried to kill him. because he was in the way of my getting what I wanted, which was to get away with that bank robbery.
And so did you shoot him as soon as he approached the car?
What happened was when he puts on the lights, because remember he's looking for a red sports car because he got a bad description, and I'm driving a tan car, so he didn't know I was the bank robber. And when he comes in behind me, I had stolen plates on the car, and I knew when he called those plates in, they would not match that vehicle. And so as soon as he got behind me and turned on his lights, I stepped on the brakes immediately, and he didn't know that was coming. And so he's still responding to that, stepping on his own brakes, and I'm just a second ahead of him, and I jumped out, and I shot twice at his head, shot hit him once in the eye, and the other bullet went to the side of his head. Then I walked up to the side of his car, and I emptied my gun into him, and he kicked out at me, and I turned around and left him for dead. I figured that if you shot somebody five times, that they're not going to live. And I went back to my car.
And that's when I got out of my car and went to the front of my car and drew my gun, and I yelled to freeze. And I'm thinking in my training, you can only shoot in self-defense, and he's not trying to hurt me right now, so I can't shoot him in self-defense, and I can only shoot a dangerous fleeing felon, and he's not trying to leave the area, so I got to let him get in his car and let the car move before I can shoot him. And so I'm standing there with my gun as Mark's running back and getting in his car, and then when his car moved, I remember shooting one bullet into the back window, and that back window just shattered, and I thought to myself, gee, that's neat. I've never seen a window do that before. The weird things that run through your mind. But my first bullet hit the little metal bar in the center of the headrest and ricocheted down and hit him in the left shoulder, which knocked him forward and to the right out of the way of the next five bullets, which would have hit him in the chest cavity. So my first bullet saved his life. And then I remember sitting at the front of my car watching him drive away, wondering if anybody had heard me call in that I'd been shot. In between the two shots into the windshield and him coming back and shooting me in the back, I'd gotten on my radio and screamed that I'd been shot. But I didn't know if anybody had heard me. So I got up and I went back into my car and screamed over my radio again that I'd been shot. And then somebody said, get an ambulance started. So I knew that they had heard me. So I started for the trunk of my car. And my heart was beating really fast, and I decided I better get my heart slowed down. So I laid down right next to my car and to get my heart slowed down, and my car was running. And I happened to be laying on my right side facing my car, and there's the tailpipe right in my face about 6 inches away, and I'm breathing the exhaust, and I can't get up. So I'm laying there breathing exhaust, and I wasn't a Christian at that point in my life, but I remember I said a prayer, and the exact words in my prayer were, God, I don't know if I'm going to die. If I do, take care of my wife, please help me. No sooner did I say that prayer than a truck driver come running up and said, what can I do to help? And I said, turn off my car before it kills me. And he got my car shut off, and then another officer showed up, a Rock Springs City officer showed up and to start first aid on me, and then a state trooper showed up right after that, and they took care of me, and Mark drove on up the road.
Where did you go?
I'd been shot, and I didn't get far, probably about a mile. Steve's best
friend. 3 miles, exactly.
Okay, 3 miles. Steve's best friend had responded, and he got a shotgun out of his car, and he fired into my car. It hit the windshield, and I didn't even know it at the time. My adrenaline was so amped up. I didn't know it, I don't think, till years later, until I saw a picture of the car. But his friend Tracy pulled his car across the front of the road, so I wasn't going forward. My car was shot up, and it's a little Plymouth Champ, and it top ends out at 80 miles an hour. I'm not out running the police cars, and I'm out in the middle of the desert. So I got out, grabbed the money, and I started running across the desert with the gun in my hand and the money And so by this time, a number of police agencies started showing up. Rock Springs Police, Green River Police, the Sheriff's Department, Highway Department. And they come in behind me. And I would guess 50 yards, 75 yards, I'm guessing. They fired over 30 shots, and they missed all of them. And I attribute that to Christ's intervention, because these guys definitely wanted to take me down. I just shot one of their own, and they didn't know if he was dead or not at that point. And I laid in a little gully, wasn't very deep, probably 12 inches, and I looked down. I had three bullets in my gun, and there was five officers in a semicircle out maybe 50 yards from me. And behind them, there was another 10 or 15 officers and more coming. And I said, this is not going to work, and I gave up at that point.
A bad day to shoot an officer. Because of that funeral, every officer in Sweetwater County was suited up and going to be going to that funeral. So when the call of an officer down went out, the troops came. You couldn't have gotten that many officers to show up in one spot. Bad day to shoot a police officer. But Tracy took Mark into custody, and because of his wound, transported him to the hospital. And an ambulance came and got me, of course. And so we ended up in the hospital right next to each other in the emergency room with just a curtain between us. No, I didn't know Mark was over there. Of course, they were working on me, and the things they were doing to me in the emergency room was almost as bad as being shot, you know, putting a stomach pump in me and draining the blood off my chest cavity and stomach cavity and catheters and all those good things. But Mark was laying right there listening to the whole thing.
I think you should share with him the story about the nose.
Oh, the old doc that was working on me is an old timer, and he said, I'm going to put a stomach pump in you, and it's going in your nose. And I swear it was a fire hose that he grabbed. But anyways, he tried to put it in my nose, and my nose had been busted so much when I was in high school playing football and basketball, he couldn't get it in. And he goes, well, your nose has been busted a few times. One more time isn't going to hurt. And he just took his fist and smashed my nose flat, and at the same time was shoving that stomach pump in me. So I got my nose busted in the emergency room.
So how long were you there for?
In the hospital? The surgery, was like 8 hours. They did 8 hours worth of surgery on me, sewing everything up, all the holes in my intestines and stomach, and cut out part of my liver and took my eye out. So the surgery was 8 hours. I was in intensive care for 3 days, a regular room for 5 days, and then they let me out. It wasn't because they wanted to. It was because I was too ornery. Every time the doctor came in, I told him I wanted out, and he finally got fed up with me badgering him, and he said, when you can walk up and go to the bathroom by yourself, I'll let you out. And somehow I made it out of bed and made it into the bathroom, and he said, you need to be in here for 2 weeks, but I'm not going to argue with you. So they took me home and put me to bed, and I slept for a couple weeks. I'd wake up and eat and go back to sleep.
So what happened to you after you were released from the hospital?
There was officers there with me, of course, and they took me right to the jail as soon as they took the bullet out, and I went to jail.
You know, there's so many interesting things in this story. After I'd recovered back out on the streets, Mark was sitting in the county jail waiting for trial and sentencing, and we'd arrested a couple really bad people who had committed a murder. There was actually three of them, and they were in the same cell block with Mark, and one of them murdered one of the others, and I happened to be dropping tickets off at the sheriff's office when one of the detention officers come running out and goes, so-and-so killed so-and-so, back me up. I have nobody else. So I went running into the jail with him, and I'm still carrying my firearm, which is an absolute no-no, but I didn't even think about it. I just ran with him. Well, here's the dead person, and right next to the dead person who's laying on his bunk in his cell happens to be Mark sitting in his cell. Now, I look at him and I'm thinking, I got my gun, I'm going to kill him. And I started to reach for my gun and I went, oh God, no. And I ran out of there and the detention officer's going, whoa, Steve, come back. And I'm running out of there. And as I'm running out, some more officers are running in. But I had the opportunity to kill Mark while he was in his cell. And I actually thought about it.
Did you know that?
Well, there was a big guy. And he come and get me, give me the meanest look I've ever seen. And he was about as close as you are to me, just on the other side of the bars. And when he left, I asked the jailer, who was that guy? And he had that big gun on his side. He says, oh, that's the guy you shot. And I kind of gulped because I knew that if he had just pulled the gun out, that all that was between us was the bars and there was nothing stopping him. So I felt fortunate that day. There was, as Steve said, there had been a number of fortunate instances. I call it tribute to God's intercession. I shot Steve five times, and three of the bullets, any one of the three should have been lethal. The one to the liver, the one to the eye that stopped right at his brain, the one to the intestines. There's one lodged today next to his spine. And God made sure that he made it.
And I didn't even suffer brain damage from the one in the eye, you know. Now, there's people that will argue and say I got brain damage. In fact, Mark would be one of them. He'd argue and say I got brain damage that day, but I really didn't. It actually stopped the thickness of a piece of paper from my brain, and it broke out the back of my eye socket. No bone fragments penetrated my brain. Now, how much closer can you get? The bullet that hit me in the liver was like a quarter of an inch from a major blood vessel, and then the ones that bounced around me and cut everything up inside me and the bullet in my spine, I should be paralyzed or a cripple, but I'm not. And like Mark says, only God intervening. Well, and Mark should be dead. My first bullet hit that little metal bar in the headrest, right in the center of the back of his head, and only got a flesh wound on the shoulder from it. And it knocked him out of the way of the next five, which would have hit him in the chest cavity. You know, it's not luck. You know, there's not that much luck in the world.
Can you talk a little bit about how your recovery went once you were out of the hospital?
It took me about 2 months to get all completely healed up, and I had to have an artificial eye before I would be allowed to go back out on the streets. But during that time, I laid around, and I had nothing to do. And nobody came and saw me or anything, and I was just filled with hate. I was so angry and so bitter and so hateful towards Mark. It was awful. And I always drank a lot before I became a cop, but now I turned into an alcoholic. And I would drink to the point of passing out. And then I would clean up all my beer cans and take them across the street and put them in my neighbor's garbage can. That poor guy, his wife really, really rode him hard about the amount of booze he was drinking, but it was mine. But my wife at that time said, if you ever turn into a drunk, I'll divorce you. And so I was hiding it, and I was taking painkillers. I did have pain after the surgeries, but it did go away, but the painkillers didn't. I kept taking them, and I become addicted to the painkillers too.
So what happened between then and now? Like, how did you?
I left the highway patrol. The post-traumatic stress that I suffered from the shooting, I couldn't get past my hatred and my anger and my bitterness, and the nightmares were awful. I'd have nightmares every night. I'd wake up screaming, and I couldn't sleep, and it just wore me out. And so I left the highway patrol and went to California and became a law enforcement chaplain out there. I'd become a Christian before I went to California. So I'm out in California, and I'm a chaplain. And one day, you know, that whole time when I was struggling, drinking and painkillers and hating Mark, my wife said to me, I don't know how long I can live in your hatred, Steve. And it didn't matter to me. My hatred was more important. And finally, one day, I just could not hate anymore. I couldn't do it. And she told me, why don't you forgive Mark? And I said, I have. And she told me I was a liar. And finally, I called the chaplain. And he said, I said, what's wrong with me? How come I have no joy? And as a Christian. And he said, well, why don't you forgive Mark? And I said, I did. And he called me a liar, and I hung up on him. And a few days later, I called him back, and I said, what do I do? And he said, why don't you just write him a letter and tell him what's on your heart? And so I had written a couple articles for a law enforcement magazine, and I decided I'd send those to him. And then I sat down to write him a letter, and I prayed about it. And I just put the pen to a piece of paper, and I wrote, I believe, what God wanted me to write. And the exact words in my letter, I'll never forget them, were, Mark, I don't wish you pain by sending these to you, meaning those two articles. I just want to share my joy with you. If you haven't already, won't you join me in Christ's love in the Christian family? And I signed my name and I shipped it off.
What was it like receiving that package?
It was a big shock first, because 4 years had gone by, or 3 years at that point, and I hadn't heard anything. And it was a little bit of a relief. I knew I'd impact his life. I didn't know the extent until we became friends, but I was glad to hear from him. In fact, Steve will tell you, my first letter back was 17 pages long.
18.
Okay. So we started corresponding. And
you know what day you wrote that? He wrote it on March 18th.
Wow.
Yeah.
On the anniversary. Okay.
That was the date on your letter, March 18th. And that's something else I'll never forget.
What was in those 17 pages?
Probably just pouring out my heart. Remorse. Probably telling him what I've been doing with my Steve can probably remember better than I can.
Yeah, it was just a general what life was like for him, you know, and that he felt bad for shooting me and that he was relieved to know that I no longer hated him. That's what was in it.
We corresponded for 9 months, and then I'm not sure. You said it was your chaplain or your pastor up in Upton.
I had left California and come to Wyoming, and I was traveling around sharing my story in churches, and I happened to be in Upton, Wyoming, and when I was a kid growing up, that when we went to church, we would go to the Methodist church. Well, the Methodist minister called me up and said, "There's a Christian revival down in Rollins. Do you want to go? The guy that shot you will be there." And, you know, I was learning to be obedient to God at that point in time. And I said, absolutely not. I'm not ready for this. And it was like God put dropped a semi truck on me. And all of a sudden I went, oh, man, I can't take this feeling. Yeah, I'll go. And it was like God lifted that weight off of me. So I planned on going down to Rollins to the Christian revival and seeing Mark for the first time. And the night before the revival, I sat in my room praying, you know, God, whatever I do or whatever I say when I first see Mark, let it be from you. And I prayed that all night. I didn't sleep. I couldn't. It was too much emotion there. And so I prayed that all night long. And then we went into the prison. And I walked into the gymnasium, and the door opened on the other side, and the inmates walked in, and there was Mark.
A couple things. First, Steve would be the first one to tell you that when he first saw me, he had some thoughts going through his head and said, I can take him. I can do him right now. I'm pretty sure.
It was even more than that. It was when we hugged that I thought that I got my arms around him. I'm thinking, God, I can kill him. I know how to.
When I first saw Steve, I even though we'd been writing for 9 months,
I went out and talking. Collect calls, by the way.
Okay. I went up to shake his hand, and he gave me this big bear hug, and there were some people in there that were stunned, some hardened cop haters that had been through in and out of the system all their lives, and didn't have a good view of law enforcement, and would come up to me later and told me how moved they were. And I just that moment – there was guys that would come up to me 5, 10, 15 years later and still could remember that moment of him hugging me, and they knew what I had done to him. So that was a big moment, and we talked for about an hour at that revival. And then after that, we continued to write, and I put Steve on my visiting list, and his kids grew up in the visiting room coming, seeing me. For a while, I was at the Honor Farm, and they would bring picnic baskets up there. And
they have barbecues.
Barbecues. And one of the strange things, I think, about this relationship, and it's not strange to either Steve or I, is the normalcy. By that, I'm very cognizant of what I did to Steve and the ongoing effect in his life. But when he comes to spend time with me, or we write letters, or we talk on the phone, or we work on projects together, we enjoy each other's company. We don't think it abnormal, and people from the outside looking in. The first thing that we think about is not the shooting that day or the impact of our lives. We think about whatever's at hand at that moment, that project, that whatever we're working on.
Or the future.
Or the future, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't harp on the shooting. That, you know, that's done, gone, and over with. And, you know, God's using that for great things in our lives. And so, yeah, we talk about today and the future and, you know, other things.
The other thing is, well, there's a lot of things I want to share, is Steve and his wife, Marion, tried to get me to be a Christian for many years, many years. And I wanted no part of that. I saw the effect of his forgiving me, and I was grateful for the forgiveness, but I didn't feel moved towards Christ. And I'd grown up in a Christian home. I went to Sunday school and church and Bible camp and confirmation studies, and to me these were all just stories. And I didn't believe in it. I didn't buy in it. And I told Steve I wasn't going to use it just because he wanted me to be a Christian. So I didn't become a Christian until 2004. So in terms of my incarceration, we're talking now only 9 years ago. It's a fairly recent phenomenon, while Steve has been a Christian for nearly 30 years now.
What changed in 2004?
What changed in go ahead.
Me praying for him. I've been praying for him for 24 years. He owes me 24 years worth of prayers. But I'm praying for him, and
I don't think that hurt a bit.
I know it didn't.
I think what I'd accomplished a lot of things in prison. I brought private industry into the prison, helped start a youth outreach group, was first inmate in the history of Wyoming Corrections, earned a bachelor's group, a lot of things, a lot of pluses. I had Steve's support for my release, my judges, my victims, and I couldn't get out of prison. And Steve had been run for governor that year, and he knew Governor Freudenthal. And Governor Freudenthal knew Steve's wishes to get me out of prison. And he never told Steve that he was going to let me out, but Steve never had any reason not to believe. And I believed I was going to get out. And I'd had a number of recommendations, and when I got turned down, it all of a sudden sunk on me. I said, there's nothing you can do, Mark. You can't work your way out of prison. I don't care how many college degrees you get, you know, how much private industry you get, how many these kids groups, there's nothing you can do. There's nothing in of yourself you can do. And I had some anger. I had some anger that I couldn't, with my own actions, better my condition. And I ended up going to the hole down there. That was a strange deal. I got into a fight with a guy, and I never even hit him. I actually was walking away. I went into the hole down there in Nevada. And it was the coldest I'd ever been in my life. I've never felt cold like that. They had air conditioning on, and I didn't have a coat or anything. And God just humbled me. And at that moment, I knew. I said, this is it. There's something besides me. And the realization came. I mean, at that moment in that cell, I needed God in my life. There was more.
God come to solitary confinement.
Yeah. Well, I needed to be humbled. That's the bottom line. I needed to be humbled. And 20 years of prison hadn't done it. It took a little bit more.
I'm curious, you know, Steve talked about the hate that he had after the shooting. Did you have hate, like, once you were in prison as well?
Never any hate towards him. Anybody that's done a lot of time gets angry at times or resentful or hope. They want out. And part of the thing is I've watched many guys over the years. I've watched guys do murders, multiple murders, two and three murders, and get out. And I sit here year after year. And so there's
God has a reason, you know. Yeah. There's a reason why that, you know, Mark isn't out. And it's because God wants him here. God has something for him to do here, and Mark's not going to get out until he accomplishes that.
Well, I think part of it was if God had let me out right away, I wouldn't become a Christian. I would have turned my back on him. It would have been too easy. But he said, okay, now that you're a Christian, you have plenty of time to read the Bible and get your roots deep. And so I think part of that for me was getting to know him. If I had been released right away, it probably would not have been it would not have been my best interest. So he needed me to stay here to get my roots deep.
Remember that time you said, you know, I'm glad that I'm still here? And I went, holy cow, how in the world can you say something like that? And Mark said, because I have the opportunity now to get well-grounded in my faith and my belief in God and Jesus Christ. Because I thought it was weird, you know. it's...
Well, Steve will also tell you the best day of his life.
Was when Mark shot me. And Mark goes, whoa, that's weird. And I'm going, you know, if you hadn't shot me, I wouldn't be where I am today. I wouldn't have the faith that I have today. So, yeah, getting shot was the best thing that ever happened to me, and the best thing that's ever happened to Mark was
going to prison.
Going to prison.
Because there's no way if I hadn't gone to prison that I would have humbled myself. I was too prideful, too arrogant, too self-centered.
And then also we wouldn't have this friendship.
No, we wouldn't.
We wouldn't have this friendship. You know, and man, I would die before I gave up this friendship with Mark. You know, it's funny because people think that Mark's the only one that benefits from this. And one of my sisters called me and she goes, it just dawned on me, you're benefiting from this, aren't you? And I went, well, yeah, isn't it obvious? And she goes, it never really sank in. I never really understood it, Steve, until today. You drive clean across the state of Wyoming to go see him. You must be getting something out of this. And I said, well, yes, I am.
So what is it? What are you getting out of?
Friendship. Love. You know, I love Mark like a brother, and he loves me. And, you know, it's weird, but...
Love is absolutely at the center. Christ is at the center. Shared values, compassion,
political views.
Oh no, no. Steve is a little to the right of Genghis Khan for all you Republicans out there, and I'm a little to the left of Obama. So,
Mark, we were talking one time, and Mark said, "You know, I used to be a Republican." I said, "Well, what happened to you?" And he goes, "Prison."
yeah, prison will do that in a heartbeat.
but yeah, I've gotten more out of this than. Probably, I think Mark has.
No. One of the neat things for me has been, we talked earlier about the anger. When Steve visits me, I get to see the socket where there's no eye. When he talks to me, we never have whining sessions or complaining sessions, but things will come up in the course of a conversation like you would with any friend. For example, in the last 5 years, he's been through three operations, three or four, that are attributed to the shooting, and the state doesn't pay for it. And so he's about $120,000 to $150,000 in debt. So the shooting consequences are still going on. They're still taking parts of his body. The bullet that's lodged next to his spine causes neuropathy, so he's not getting the proper circulation in his legs, and he gets infections easily when he steps on things. And when he's gotten these infections, the first one started when they shipped some of us out of state, and I was down in Texas, I would guess about 2005. They shipped 500 of us out of state because Wyoming was overcrowded, and he got this infection in the bones, and it wouldn't heal, and they tried antibiotic after antibiotic. And they were getting ready to tell him they had to amputate his foot. And at that time, there was myself and two other inmates that were going into the chapel. I was a Christian by that time. And we were praying for him about a half hour a day. and finally an antibiotic took, and they were able to deal with it. But the next time it hit him, a year later, he got an infection in that foot. They ended up taking one of his toes, and then the infection would hit again, and they ended up taking more toes, more bones, and it continues. He had another operation where when I shot him in the intestines, your intestines lay on top of each other, and some of the walls were weakened where I'd shot him, and 30 years later, they had ruptured, and so he got the waste inside him, and he was very, very sick. And the doctor didn't attribute to the shooting because that was something that happened 30, but we know where the bullet went, and so because he didn't, workman's comp doesn't cover it. Workman's comp doesn't cover the infections in the feet where he keeps going back and they keep taking bones out and taking bottom parts. But when he shares these things with me, and he's never complaining. He's just talking as you would talk to a friend, you to a girlfriend or me to a friend, saying this is what's going on in my life. I see the ongoing impact. He's still undergoing PTSD. I mean, the slightest sound, smell, a police car, a car back, the slightest. Steve could tell you more often than I do where relives the shooting, and it's many times a day, and he's still going through it at night. So this is having a daily impact on you. And because I'm familiar with it or aware of it, you were talking about restorative justice. As the perpetrator, I can't see myself as the victim. I can't say, wow, I've done 30 years in prison. My life is gone. Because I get to see that he's in a prison. I get to see that he's spending his life now on crutches or in a wheelchair because of what I've done to him. I get to see the pain that he goes in. When we're talking, you'll see little things will come up. For example, he couldn't play football with his kids because of the bullet next to his spine. So he lost out on a lot of stuff. Recently he told me he was going to do some things like ride a four-wheeler because he didn't do it when his kids were younger. He was afraid of getting paralyzed because of the bullet that's still next to his spine. And so
I always had to, as being the father and the provider, had to think of my family, and so there's many things I never did after the shooting because I couldn't take a chance of becoming paralyzed and not being able to provide for my family. So if I had to do something that would risk paralyze me, I would if I absolutely had to. But if it was something that I didn't have to do, I wouldn't do it, like riding a four-wheeler. And so I'm going to crawl on a four-wheeler, and I'm going to go ride a four-wheeler, maybe a snowmobile, so there's a lot of things that I haven't done that I am going to do, that's what Mark's talking about, the restorative justice. I wouldn't trade places with Mark for anything. I can't believe how hard being my friend is for Mark. It's like Mark said, every time he sees me, he has to think about what he did to me. Because of that, every time he deals with someone else, he has to think of how I would do it. He has to stop, and if he's angry at somebody, think about how I forgave him. It's hard. It's hard for me because just now when Mark was talking, the pain he's suffering from talking about it hurts me. So I jumped in to give you a breath of air there, and now you're back in business.
Well, one of the good things, and there's some good things that have come out of this event. We know from Romans 8:28 that all things it's possible. Anyway, one of the good things that came out of the out of this event is that when I share the testimony of Steve's forgiveness, I've seen the impact on other people's lives. When I was out of state, they moved us to different prisons. I was down there in Oklahoma, and I was at the church, and I shared it, the inmate church, with what I'd done and the impact on Steve's lives and his forgiveness. And about a month later, an inmate came up to me, and I didn't know him. And he said, "I want to thank you." And I said, "What do you want to thank me for?" And he said, "When you shared the testimony a month ago about Steve forgiving you after what he did," and he said, "I had to forgive my dad." He said, and I don't know what his dad did, but for 10 years, he had refused to allow his dad to visit. Every letter his dad had sent, he tore up. And he immediately went back to the cell block and called his dad and forgave him. And they had resumed a relationship. Hmm. When Steve came up here a year ago, August, and he spoke.
At the inmate church service?
Yes, at the inmate church service. I came back to the block, and one of the guys is on the phone, and he's calling people to forgive them, things that he had held grudges against. And then he wrote letters to those people that weren't on his phone list. So I've seen the impact. Steve will tell you about the Indiana trooper that—
Yeah, I had this young lady come up to me down at the state capitol, and she said, "Are you the guy that book was written about?" And I said, "Yeah." And she goes, "My mom wanted me to tell you that my grandfather was an Indiana state trooper, retired, and just before he died, he read that book and he became a Christian just before he died." And there, I could go on forever. I could talk from now until we're done about stories of forgiveness out on the streets that have happened with people that I've shared with the story with, and they're just going that is so amazing. And I tell them, you know, I just happen to be the lucky sucker that was given this story. You know, I can't figure out why God thinks I'm so special that He would give me such a story. Why Mark's so special that God would give him such a story. Our lives are so tied together. The story's so tied together that it just never stops. It goes on and on and on, and it's amazing. It's a purpose.
Restorative justice doesn't necessarily have to involve forgiveness, right?
It involves forgiveness. Everybody deserves to be forgiven. I don't care who you are. Everybody deserves to be forgiven. Okay, but now the friendship, that's totally different. Okay, I think everybody should become friends with someone who shot him 5 times? Absolutely not. But was it the right thing for me? Yes, it was. Because at one point, you know, when I forgave Mark, okay, I asked myself, you know, what would Jesus do? Okay, and I knew that Jesus forgives. Jesus will forgive everybody. Okay. And so I had to forgive Mark. And then I asked myself, I think Jesus would be friends with the guy that shot him 5 times. And as Mark and I corresponded back and forth, it just naturally happened. I found out, you know, when he was a military police officer in the Army, law enforcement, and his dad was a cop.
I got to jump in here. There's many stories with this friendship. It's 31 years. My father was a policeman for 16 years, and when I shot Steve, he couldn't deal with it. To a policeman, a cop shooter is the worst thing. It's absolutely the worst. And every letter I sent to him, he tore up. Every birthday card, every Christmas card, every Father's Day card for 5 years. People would ask him how your son is, and he said, "I don't have a son." And Steve wrote him and said, "If I can forgive him, why can't you?" And my dad, the
forgave me after that. And my dad's relationship and mine has never been better. And it, the power of this story of his forgiveness, it just affects life after life after life for
and,
the good.
And now Mark and Mark's dad and I are good friends. And his sisters and I are good friends. And in fact, this summer I'm going back, and I'm going to meet his uncles and his family back there. And I can't wait. I can't wait to be part of Mark's family.
Yes, part of the family. Yes.
Part of the family. And his dad's got such a great sense of humor. You know, why don't you tell that story of what your dad said about introducing yourself?
You tell it. You tell it.
Mark said to his dad, man, what a great friend Steve is. And his dad goes, yeah, you've really got a good friend there, son, but you really need to tone down your introductions a little bit, meaning don't shoot him.
To back up, can you both tell me what restorative justice actually means for you? Like, how do you define it?
I want to get back to the forgiveness a minute. Okay, whether you're a Christian or not a Christian, forgiveness is not about the person that you're forgiving. You're doing that for yourself.
Yeah.
And I recently had an inmate do something to me that was totally out of line. It was totally wrong, and I got mad at him for a day, and it was stupid because I know that all I'm doing is hurting myself. And I said, I made the decision. I'm going to forgive him. So I went up to him and I shook his hand. I said, hey, I hope the best happens. I hope this works out best for you, blah, blah, blah. And he was shocked. He was stunned because he saw that it was a genuine gesture and I wasn't being sarcastic. But it was a load that came off of my shoulders, and I could put that little thing away, and that was behind me. And I can tell you about 100 incidents, 1,000 instances over the years, where I've made the decision to forgive somebody, whether it's a family member, whether it's an inmate, whether it's a staff member, and I just forgive them. Make the choice. When you forgive them, you can put you can go forward instead of looking back.
And hanging on to that and staying in the same spot, because that's what you do. You're just staying in that one spot, and you can't move on until you do forgive. And so whether you're a Christian or not, you have to forgive. And it's for you, not for that other person. They don't even have to know that you've forgiven them. So you got to forgive to move on. And restorative justice to me, is for the offender to try to make their victim as whole as possible. Yes. And that's what restorative justice is. Is for the offender to make their victim whole, or society as whole as possible, to heal over those wounds, to do what they must do, you know, because there is a debt to pay, and the debt is to the victim and to society.
And where it's possible, sometimes the victims don't want to ever face,
and that's understandable,
the offender, perpetrator, but where it's possible, I think the victim is owed the opportunity to try to make the perpetrator understand the pain, the impact on their life. Because so often the perpetrator doesn't realize, doesn't understand.
Remember that one time we were I was visiting you, and you were down, kind of down in the dumps, and I said, what's wrong? And you said, all these guys around here, you know, can eventually twist it around to where it's their victim's fault, okay? If she didn't dress that way, or if they wouldn't have been in that parking lot in the dark, or whatever, you know, the situation might be, they twist it around to where it's the victim's fault. All right. And Mark said to me, I can never do that. Every time I talk to you, see you, I have to remember what I did to you. And so even though it's hard, Mark gets to see the price that his victim's paying. And so many times you come in here and you serve, you're here for a number of years, and you've after the trial, you've never heard anything of your victim. You don't know anything. So if the victim can ever sit down across from the perpetrator and say, I have nightmares every single night because of you. I'm scared. or whatever the case might be. Now that person has to look at their victim and they see a human being that they've damaged, that they've hurt.
So that's for the victim. Like, what is the, how does that work for the perpetrator?
There's a, for me, there's a humanizing in terms of, it would really be easy in prison to get hardened, to get bitter, okay, especially during lengthy periods of time. But when you understand that you're responsible for the pain and you see that person and you have the empathy and the compassion, I'm not saying everybody will or every perpetrator, but where the perpetrators can get that, there's a humanizing. And it, for me, I definitely have more empathy today for my fellow man than I did prior to coming to prison. Part of it is the pain of doing time. Doing time is painful. Part of it is, a big part of it is becoming a Christian. Part of it is seeing the pain that I've brought into Steve's life. So for the perpetrator, I think there's a humanizing, and that's important. We don't want to send people out of prison that are callous, that are cold, that are calculating. If I've seen the pain, I'll give you a story. It just happened yesterday. A guy says to me, he says, you were up at the farm, and they sent all the long-termers back. I didn't screw up. They sent all the long-termers back due to politics. And he said, why didn't you run off? He said, you had all that time. He said, if I had all that time, I would have run off. And I said, I'm done. I'm done causing pain in people's lives. I says, if you run off, you've got to steal somebody's car. You've got to break into somebody's house. You've got to do something illegal. I said, I'm not going to cause any more pain. I'm done. And I said, I cannot bring any more pain. And when I see the pain I caused in Steve's life and I walk out of here, I can't do something. Not only not pick up a gun, I just can't do something that's going to bring pain like that into somebody's life again. And I think for the perpetrators, for them to see the pain that they've caused, it humanizes them. And that makes them safer for society, much safer. Riverton had a project. I've still got the clipping in my house a few years back where they matched up 77 offenders with 77 victims. And at the end of 3 years, not one of those perpetrators had reoffended. Not one. Zero had reoffended.
Now, these are misdemeanor crimes that were done.
I don't know.
I believe they were.
Okay.
But it works. I don't care what the crime is. It works. When offenders can see the damage that they've done and put a face to it and humanize it,
yeah.
People get it's hard to hurt another person, you know, again.
Logistically, then, is it something the victim has to request?
Say that again, I'm sorry.
Like, logistically, is it something the victim would have to request to, like, have this sort of need?
I don't know if Mark said the program in Riverton, but I'm not real familiar with it. But yeah, it's something, you know, in the I'm involved with Restorative Justice International, and that's usually how it happens. Is the victim says, "I want to meet the man that did this to me, or the woman that did this to me, or whatever." And then it's a process of getting both of them together. But we really don't have a program in Wyoming, and that's something that I'm going to work on as a legislator is to get a program started, because I believe in it. I believe that it's a good thing. When back in 1986, when I said, you know, I want to go visit Mark, Department of Corrections kind of went, "Whoa, we've never had this before," and it took a little, it took some prodding and pushing for Mark and I to be able to bring that about. You know, they first said, "Well, geez, Mark's going to have to approve, you know, for you to come and visit." And I went, "Hold on a second, what's he got to approve? If I'm the victim and I want to see him, I should be able to see him." But thank goodness we were friends, and so it worked out. It really was pretty easy. But I can see where, you know, if the victim and the offender aren't friends, that you know, it will be a hard thing to do. You know, it's hard for prisons and correctional systems to bring that together, because there, you know, there's security issues and all these other things. But for me, the bottom line is if the victim wants to meet the offender, they should be able to do it.
In a safe and secure manner.
Yeah, in a safe and secure manner. Yeah.
There's a lot of ways you could do it. You could set it up where they have these non-contact glass booths where they – inmates that have been in trouble or protective custody, they could put an inmate on one side and the victim on the other, so the victim is safe. They could,
but I think at that point in time, when that meeting happens, it's not like the victim's just going to walk in and throw the inmate, and there's going to be plenty of people around. You know, I think that there has to be some counseling of the victim and counseling of the inmate and some game plans of how this meeting's going to go in that. Mark and I just happened to do it on our own. We kind of freelanced it.
Wyoming's missing the boat. They've got a lot of money, and so they don't mind spending it. And I've watched them just build prison after prison, pour it down the hole. And the boat they're missing – on this restorative justice is, we know it works. We know it works firsthand. And they could implement laws and give this would be a great tool for judges to hold over the heads of people that are, you know, if you don't do this, you don't make amends. A hypothetical that I share with other inmates, suppose you break into this guy's garage and you go steal his lawnmower. And you get $25 to go get high, and you think that's no big deal. So you go to court, they catch you, and they say, okay, here's what you're going to do. You're going to pay for the lawnmower, and you're going to go fix the guy's garage. And so you go over there, and if you don't, you're going to prison, by the way. You go over there, and you find out that's a $300 lawnmower that you hawked for $25. Now, you got to come up with $300 even though you only got $25. You had no idea. And the guy says, I need you to replace the garage door, the one that you broke to get in. And you find out that's a $1,000 garage door. And now you need to paint the garage to
match
the garage door. And you're painting that, and you're out there, and you find out his kids don't come into the backyard. He's got a couple little kids. And you say, why don't your kids come to the backyard? And he says, my wife is afraid to let them play. After you broke into the garage, she's afraid that other bad people might come and hurt them now. So now you're realizing, man, I just took a lawnmower. I didn't realize. And you say to the guy, why don't you just pay for this garage door? I have your homeowner's insurance.
Yeah.
Pay. Why am I have to pay for this? And the guy says, well, I've got a $1,500 deductible. I would have had to pay. And all of a sudden you're aware that the wife is having nightmares. She's afraid that the kids are going to get hurt. The kids can't go out and play in their yard. This $25 lawnmower would have cost this guy $2,800. You see the impact. And so this is where if we gave them that tool where it's possible, then we could put them next to the victims to see the impact on their lives and try to restore them emotionally and physically where possible.
Yeah.
I the next time the guy's not going to steal that $25 lawnmower, the cost was too great. So
plus on top of it, he gets fined and – you know, maybe probation, you know, but he has to restore the victim as completely as possible. And it's going to happen. It's going to happen in Wyoming. And it's becoming a popular, not popular, but it's being used more and more in around the world in other states. And I'm excited. I'm excited about being part of restorative justice. It's and I talk about it a lot when I'm out on the streets too with people. You know, in those cases where the victim can't meet their offender, if we can find an offender that's committed a similar crime that victim could sit down and talk with now. They're both benefiting again. It doesn't necessarily have to be the victim, original victim and original offender. Just having a victim who's been raped, sit down with some other person who is guilty of sexual crimes, you know, and say, this is what this rape did to me. And this guy's sitting over there going, wow, that my victim's probably feeling the exact same things. And here the victim is they're getting all this stuff off their chest, you know, of sharing and telling, you know, this is what you did to my life. You know, telling your counselor what happened, you know, and what's going on in your life's one thing, but to get it out, oh man, there's something about getting it out that frees a person.
You guys are both Christians, and from what I've read in other restorative justice cases that actually went through and had the meeting and some sort of resolution, they often are Christians, as the people that request the meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think to some extent that's necessary for that kind of approach to be welcomed? Or
I think it helps.
It definitely helps, but remember, I didn't become a Christian until 2004.
Yeah.
And I still felt remorse after meeting Steve and talking to Steve and seeing the impact. There was definitely a huge amount of empathy and compassion even prior to being a Christian. So for people that are not Christians and haven't decided to make Christ the center of their life, it's still a good move, and they can still gain from both the perpetrator and the victim.
Yeah. I think that, you know, I do think being a Christian does help, but is it necessary? No, you know.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, you said you look at your relationship, your friendship as very normal, and a lot of people don't. So, like, how have people reacted when you do share your story? And, you know, you've worked to try and get Mark out as mm-hmm. well. So, like, how do people...
I've lost friends. I've lost friends in law enforcement. You know, but, oh, well, that's their problem, not mine. You know, I'm not going to change what I'm doing, simply because, some of my friends in law enforcement disapprove, they don't like it. That's their problem, not mine. Most people look at me like I am the weirdest person, that I did suffer brain damage that day, but I didn't. And I am, I guess maybe I am weird, but that's okay. I'm happy with it, you know. But it's – I love telling my story. I speak in churches. I travel around. I plan on doing a bunch of traveling this summer and sharing my story and telling people about forgiving Mark and becoming friends and being a Christian and all the neat things that have happened to Mark and I. People need to hear it, you know. Getting shot could have been one of the worst things that ever happened. But you know what is even worse is if nobody ever gets anything good out of it. And man, we're getting lots of good out of it. I'm getting it. Mark's getting it. You're getting it today.
What about from your point of view? I mean, you interact a lot more with perpetrators of other crimes as well, right? So
yeah.
How do they react to your story?
Ones that don't know me. Initially, they say, oh, you shot a cop. And I say, oh, yeah, good going, you shot a cop. And I say, no, it wasn't good going. And I'll explain that he's become my best friend and all the pain he's gone through and all he's done for me. And I'll change at least the way they interact with me, at the very least. I have no doubt that based on how Steve has treated me, that many, many, many inmates – have a different view of at least some law enforcement and see some law enforcement more as humans and the people just doing jobs. Different. No, go ahead.
And here's a neat thing, okay? Mark calls me on the phone and I'm going, oh, man, this is going on in my life. I need prayer. So what's he do? He goes and gets a bunch of other inmates and they go out in the yard and stand in a circle and hold hands and pray around and around for me. These convicts are praying for a cop, and it just blows my mind. And some of these inmates have written me letters, you know, and I'm praying for them, you know, and I'm going I wrote one inmate, I go, you know, I've been praying for you. It's really strange, really weird for me, a cop, to be praying for an inmate. And he wrote me back going, yeah, I know, I pray for you, and it's really weird, you know. And here these guys are, and all these inmates, other inmates, know who they're praying for, a cop. And it's just unheard of for inmates to be praying for a cop. And then it also has it's got to have an effect on the correctional officers, you know, to see these inmates praying for me.
Well, I guess the question is, does the fact that you worked in law enforcement, does that add an extra dimension of weirdness to the
story? Yeah, it does. It really does. And so, yeah, it's awesome. All I need to do is let Mark know I need prayer, and there is 100 guys in here that Mark's going to have praying for me. Immediately.
So you're both saying that this could work for anybody. You know, I've heard that it works a lot for misdemeanors, more minor crimes, not so much for murders, attempted murders. So do you think that it really could be a system that's applied to any level of crime?
I think if you make the decision that you don't want to, some people decide, I want to own this. I want to be a victim all my life. I want to be angry. I want to be bitter. This is my identity. I don't want to have a normal life. If you make the decision that no matter what my loss is, that I've lost this loved one, or I've been sexually assaulted, or somebody stabbed me, whatever your loss, if you say, I want to get past that, and what do I need to make the decision to get, and I'm willing to do that, if they make that decision, this can work for them. If they want to own the bitterness, Steve and I can talk to them until we're blue in the face. They've got to make a decision. Steve had to make a decision that he didn't want to be angry anymore.
And the system wants you to stay a victim. They want you to be a victim. You know? They don't want you to move on.
How so? Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah. Workman's comp is one of the things that irks me. it's like they don't want me to be well. They don't want to help me be well. They want me to stay dependent. Society wants you to stay dependent. I've lost my train of thought. Jump in here. Help me out until I can think.
Good luck on that. I don't think society is, it's kind of hard. But society doesn't hold victims accountable in the terms, and this is really going to sound bad, but telling them, look, you can make a difference in your life. You don't have to remain bitter. You don't have to remain, and don't say there is a choice. I think too often society wants to say poor you, and I don't want Steve to live the way he was living before he forgave me. I don't want him to be angry. I don't want him 24 hours a day where all he's thinking about is killing me, getting even with me. Angry, can't even think about the next thing. I own him. I'm in his thoughts 24. I don't want that. Okay, I want him to be free, and he is free today. And any victim can do that. They can put that aside if they make that decision that this is not what I want. But somebody needs to tell them, you don't have to be a victim. You're always going to be a victim in the sense that this event happened to you, but you don't have to have that victim mentality. You can say, this isn't going to own me. I'm going to put this – and you know what? Even if this person that did this, whatever it is not going to be remorseful, is not going to be sorry for what they did, I'm going to forgive them because I want this behind me. I don't want to live – whatever I've got left in life, I don't want that in my head for 24 hours a day. I want to enjoy the rest of my life. And what I really think we need to encourage victims in that sense, that the event doesn't define them from now on.
You know, people saying, I can't. You know, when I said I'm going to forgive Mark, they said, you can't. And I'm going, why not? And that's where, you know, they want you to stay a victim. If I want to go in and see Mark and they threw this wall up and said, no, you can't, then they're trying to make me stay a victim. I don't want to be a victim. I want to move on. I want to take, as Mark said, control of this anger, this bitterness. When I was hating Mark, did you even know I hated you?
No.
You didn't know I hated you. And the only person that was hurting was me and everybody else around me. That's the only ones that were hurting. Not Mark. He was just trying to live. In fact, if you think about it, when I forgave him and become friends with him, now he has to think about it every single day, what he did to me. Now, that's punishment. Oh, man, what torture that is. But that isn't why I forgave him or become friends with him. I didn't want to torture him. But if you think of it like that, you know, now he's got to remember, think about me every single day.
When there's no contact, as there hadn't been for the first 3 years, at some point, you don't sit and get up every morning and say, I shot a cop, I robbed a bank, I did this. No, you think about, what am I going to do today? Okay, I'm going to do my state job, which is working in the library or washing dishes or whatever your job is, and I'm going to watch TV or read a book or write a letter to grandma. And you're not even thinking about that person that you did that. But you are thinking, oh, what would be fun today? Maybe reading that book or playing basketball or something. But the pain of the victim is not on your mind. It's only when you get to know the victim that the empathy starts.
And now I know he thinks about me every single day because he prays for me every single morning. You know, so, yeah.
So do you think that the sort of restorative justice approach is complementary or contradictory to the current justice system that we have in place?
I think it's contradictory. You know, I'm a politician, okay?
What do you mean you're a politician? You're a state representative?
I'm a state representative, okay? And so I run for election and re-election, and you don't get elected. You get elected when you're tough on crime. You're not going to get elected if you go, you know, I'm into restorative justice, and I think that we ought to give inmates a chance, you know, and we can make life better for them and us. And nobody's going to vote for you. But, my God, throw them in the cell, lock them up, feed them bread and water, you know, beat them every day. You're going to get elected. That's how you get elected, you know. But we got to do something, you know. What we're doing now doesn't work. The recidivism rate is just outrageous. It doesn't work. I remember one time I said to Mark, I said, you know, you guys got it easy in here. This was early on in our friendship. You know, you ought to eat bread and water and break rocks all day. And Mark goes, you know what? You're right. That's what most of us deserve. But what are you going to get when we come out? Because every one of us is going to get out of here someday. Do you want an animal coming out of here, Steve? Or do you want someone who's had every opportunity to better themselves? Who do you want moving in next door to you, an animal who's broke rocks and ate bread and drank water? Or do you want someone who's been treated humanely? And I went, whoa, that kind of changed my thoughts. and I was. I actually believed that, you know, hey, prison was a piece of cake and they had it easy. And in some ways they do, but in other ways, you know what, they don't. And so, you know, the more we can educate people who have committed crimes, the more we can teach them to look at society and people as human beings. And I'm not talking about being soft on them, but giving them opportunities to better themselves, the chances of when they come out that they're going to come back are slim.
How do you get that message across to everybody else that hasn't had this kind of experience? Perhaps people that are also victims of other crimes or just, you know, society. How do you convince them that, you know, if Mark does get out early, that it's okay?
Okay. 31 years is not early.
I'm not talking about your case.
Statistics.
Or if you, like, from the process of restorative justice, someone gets either a lighter sentence or a different sentence than they would have had they gone through the court system?
That's a good question. Okay, first, is the victim better off? And the victim's better off because of the catharsis, the healing. Is society safer? We know that from the studies done that the perpetrators that are involved have – the Riverton study showed zero. So society's safer. The victim has catharsis. Why wouldn't we use something like that? And why would we build more cells, lock up more people at $50,000 a year, or use something that's working where you don't have future victims? This is a no-brainer.
If you look nationwide, everywhere, you know. Prison is a big business. The private industry prisons is a big business. And we keep, nationwide, we keep building prisons, and more people are in prison, and something isn't not working. We need to try something. And I think this is the answer. One of the easy things is well, we've tried that before and it didn't work, so we're never going to try it again. And I run into that down at the legislature. You know, we tried this before and it didn't work. Well, you know what? Maybe all the pieces weren't in the right spot. You know, maybe it wasn't the right people, but we've got to try something.
So is this something that you've kind of pitched around at the legislature?
Yeah.
What's been the reaction there?
Well, this bill needs a little more work, Steve. And I agreed, you know, because it is such a new concept. And so it's something I'm working on the interim, you know, in restorative justice where, you know, if the victim says, I want that we accommodate that victim. You know, that we'll have a program in place that that will help that victim meet that offender or meet an offender who has committed a similar crime. It doesn't always have, like I say, it doesn't always have to be the original victim and original offender and start a program. You know, and once we get some victims involved and get some offenders involved, you know, then we have, you know, a rape victim, you know, and we have five people who have committed sexual crimes who are volunteers ready to step up and say, I will talk to that victim. And they do it because they want to help that victim, you know. Wow, what an amazing concept. Inmates who want to help a victim, maybe not their victim, but it's someone else's victim because they've seen how healing it can be for that victim to sit there and cry and angrily say, this is what went on, and that perpetrator sitting there listening to him.
One thing, the DOC started a thing called Victims Impact, and it's a group where they're requiring the inmates to sit through to go before they get out. And it's a videotape, and you listen to victims describing the impact on their lives. And it's different victims. There's burglary victims, armed robbery victims, rape victims, people that have lost loved ones to murder. And the inmates have to do homework and they have to answer questions for that. So while it's not meeting the actual victims in person, it's a really strong, good first step that the DOC is just now started in the last few years. And it's getting the inmates to think more about the impact of what they did.
And how much more of an impact when we can bring that victim in, a live person, you know, human flesh, who's missing an eye or who's crippled up or whatever, you know. That's going to have a greater impact, and I'm excited about that. I'm excited about the victim to be able to sit down in front of a bunch of inmates and say, this is what happened. And so I commend the Wyoming Department of Corrections on the you know, doing this video thing. I want to move one step further and bring the victim in.
So what do you want kind of the final takeaway for the listeners to be, our listeners?
I want them to think about it, to think about how we can make society better, how we can help victims, help offenders, help ourselves, maybe reduce our taxes, you know, not build so many prisons, stop building prisons.
For me, at the bottom line on everything is forgiveness. You can't have love without forgiveness. If you have a marriage, you have to forgive your spouse when they do things because they're inevitably going to do things that you have to forgive your children when they do things. It's about forgiveness, and restorative justice comes down to forgiveness too. And if we want more out of life, we need to forgive. And I think it's in our interest to get behind that idea.